Welcome to today's deep dive. We've got a really fascinating mission for you today, diving into this stack of sources you sent over.
Yeah, it's a brilliant set of documents. Really shows the reality of land ownership right now.
Right, because we're going to show you how buying a piece of land today isn't just about, walking the boundaries and kicking the dirt.
No, not at all.
Usually when you picture real estate, you think of something deeply physical. You look at the trees and you think, like, this is it. This is what I own. It's real.
It feels tangible, right? Like you're buying pure geography, just a solid piece of the earth.
Exactly. But then you actually try to do something with that land, and suddenly the physical dirt doesn't matter nearly as much as the invisible digital layers hovering right over it.
Oh,
You've
absolutely.
got zoning codes, the mapping data, the federal legislation. You realize you didn't just buy a field in the country, you bought this highly contested intersection of law, data, and ecology.
It is the absolute definition of a regulatory minefield. I mean, what you see on the ground with your own eyes is increasingly subordinated to what the algorithms, the satellites, and, the statute books claim is on the ground.
Which brings us to the specifics of your sources today. We are exploring a real-world land use puzzle that just perfectly captures this
She
tension.
really does.
We're looking at a hyper-specific feasibility study for a 69.25-hectare parcel of land in Cygnet.
That's down in Tasmania, for context.
Right, Tasmania. And we're looking at that alongside a highly technical geographic data overlay analysis for that exact spot.
Which is where the algorithms come in.
Yeah. And finally, we'll run those local hurdles up against a massive piece of brand new federal legislation, the Nature Repair Act 2023.
So the goal here is to understand how a landowner navigates this incredibly dense web of environmental codes just to unlock the capital tied up in their land.
It's a huge undertaking.
It is, because they are facing this massive, almost philosophical dilemma, Do you slice up the land to sell it off, or do you keep it whole and enter into a decades-long federal biodiversity contract?
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the physical dune itself and the plan to slice it up. We're looking at Title 511231 in the Huon Valley.
Right.
The founder's primary goal is to take this massive 69.25-hectare piece of land and split it into three roughly equal lots, so about 23 hectares each.
Yeah, that's the plan.
They want to keep one lot to build a dwelling and, run their ecological projects, and then sell the other two lots to generate the cash needed to actually fund those
It's
projects.
a classic capital unlock play. I mean, you have an asset, you liquidate a portion of it to develop the remainder.
Makes total sense on paper.
Sure. But this entire parcel sits inside a landscape conservation zone, or LCZ. Yeah. And that zone comes with very strict rules under the Tasmanian state planning provisions. If you want a fast, guaranteed, tick-the-box approval, what the code actually calls an acceptable solution, each new lot has to be at least 50 hectares.
Wait, okay, so 69 divided by 3 is definitely not 50.
Not even close.
Even if they just cut it in half, they still fail the math test. The code essentially says this land cannot be subdivided under the basic rules.
Right, it's a hard fail on the acceptable solution, but, and this is key in planning law failing, that initial test doesn't necessarily mean you have to pack up and go home.
You can fight it?
You can shift to a discretionary approval process called the performance pathway.
Okay.
To win there, you have to prove to the local council that your proposal, despite breaking that hard 50-hectare rule, still fits the character of the area.
The character of the area.
Yeah, the specific legal phrase you have to satisfy is that your subdivision matches the pattern of development.
This is where the founder fought back with pure data, which I absolutely love.
It's brilliant.
They didn't just write a nice letter to the council asking for a favor. They ran a massive geographic data analysis of every single parcel in the Cygnet locality to prove what the actual pattern of development looks like in reality.
And the results of that analysis completely expose a disconnect between the written code and the physical world.
Yeah, it's wild.
The code demands 50-hectare lots. But when you look at the 117 LCZ parcels in the Cygnet locality, the median size is a tiny 7.23 hectares.
It's like the city telling you that you can't build a two-story house because it's too big, but you pull up the data and prove that literally everyone else on your street already lives in a three-story house.
That is a perfect analogy. The data completely undercuts the premise of the 50-hectare rule for this specific neighborhood.
Wow.
Out of those 117 local LCZ parcels, only 4 of them are 50 hectares or larger.
Only 4?
Yeah. The subject parcel we're talking about is actually the second largest LCZ parcel in the entire area.
So they completely flip the framing of the application. I mean, they aren't asking to create 3 tiny non-compliant lots. They are taking a massive anomalous landholding and turning it into 3 23-hectare lots. And those new lots are still larger than, what, 87% of all the other LCZ lots in the neighborhood.
Right. They're moving the land closer to the median, not away from it.
It's a masterful use of data to satisfy a totally subjective legal test.
It is. But proving your lot size fits the neighborhood only wins you the invisible borders on a map.
Ah, right. Back to the physical dirt.
Exactly. Once those boundaries are drawn, you still have to prove you can actually build a house on the physical terrain.
And that leads us to a massive clash of planning codes, because this land is 100% bushfire prone.
Right. It's the ultimate design battleground.
Yeah. You have code C13, the bushfire prone areas code, which basically states that if you're going to build a dwelling, you have to create a safe building envelope around it. The source mentions achieving a BAL 19 clearance.
So BAL stands for bushfire attack level. A level of 19 means the house is expected to be exposed to significant radiant heat during a fire like up to 19 kilowatts per square meter.
That sounds intense.
It is. To survive that without instantly igniting, the code mandates a physical buffer zone. You literally have to clear the native vegetation down to mineral earth or, you know, heavily managed grass for a specific radius around the house.
So it's a non-negotiable safety requirement. You must cut down trees or you cannot build.
Safety first, right.
Right. But hovering right next to that rule is code C7, the natural assets code.
This is where it gets sticky.
Very. Because this area is covered in priority vegetation, code C7 dictates that you must absolutely minimize any clearing of native plants.
Yep.
And the kicker in the fine print is that C7 offers 0 exemptions for bushfire clearance.
So you're trapped in a regulatory catch-22. The fire marshal says, cut down the trees or you can't build.
And the environmental regulator says, touch those trees and you can't build.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the million-dollar data glitch.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
Originally, the feasibility study assumed the land was 100% priority vegetation area, or PVA.
But the data analysts recomputed the overlay.
Right. They downloaded the live data layers from the government database, ran it through a new script, and the computer spit out a different number. It wasn't 100% PVA. It was 91.3% PVA.
Yeah, so somewhere on that 69-hectare block, the government's digital map believes there is 8.7% of land that is not priority vegetation.
Just like magically appearing clearings.
Exactly. The analysts found 2 specific holes or fragments in the digital vegetation layer. One is 4.16 hectares and the other is 1.86 hectares.
And the implication of that is massive. A standard bushfire clearing envelope requires, what, less than 1 hectare?
Usually.
So right. If you drop your building envelope right inside that 4-hectare hole, you completely bypass the strict clearing restrictions of code C7.
You solve the catch-22.
But wait, hold on. Wait, is this real dirt or just a glitch in the matrix? Because the source itself drops a pretty heavy warning about something called a reprojection artifact.
Yeah.
I mean, how does a government supercomputer accidentally invent 6 hectares of clear land?
What's fascinating here is how the mechanics of map making can literally dictate the legal reality of a physical piece of earth.
That's crazy.
It really is. When you deal with geographic information systems, you have to translate data between different coordinate models. Think about trying to peel an orange and then flatten the skin onto a table.
It stretches and tears.
Exactly. Yeah. Because the earth is round and computer screens are flat.
Right.
So the government might store the vegetation data in a system designed for a global view, like a web Mercator projection that's similar to what Google Maps uses.
Okay.
But to do accurate local analysis in Tasmania, you have to force the software to translate that data into a highly specific localized metric grid, like MGA 55.
So when the algorithm redraws the borders of this complex, jagged forest boundary from one mathematical model to another, the edges shift.
Yes. The math creates tiny gaps or overlaps.
Wow.
Those 2 magical holes where you're suddenly allowed to build your house might just be rounding errors in the translation software.
That's wild.
The only way to know for sure is to take those digital GPS coordinates, put your boots on, and walk out into the Tasmanian bush.
You actually have to go look at it.
Yeah. If you find a rocky outcrop or an old cleared logging track at those exact coordinates, then the digital map matches physical reality. You can build.
But if you walk out there and find a dense, ancient forest,
Then the map is hallucinating, and you are back to square one fighting the code battle.
you really cannot manage land purely from a spreadsheet.
No, you can't.
But let's assume they figure it out, right? The subdivision works, they navigate the glitches, and they sell off 2 of the 23-hectare lots.
Okay, assuming they do.
Selling off 2/3 of the land fixes the cash problem, sure, but it completely torpedoes the founders' broader ecological goals, right?
Yeah, the feasibility study explicitly warns about this opportunity cost. I mean, if you sell 2 lots, you permanently surrender control of 2/3 of your ecological asset.
Which is a huge loss if your goal is conservation.
Huge. You drastically shrink the physical area you have left for things like apiaries, foraging for botanicals, and large-scale habitat restoration.
Which forces the landowner to look for a way to monetize the dirt without touching it.
Yes.
And that leads to this wild new experiment by the federal government, which is the final source in your stack, the Nature Repair Act 2023.
It's a completely different approach.
Instead of selling the land to a developer, this framework allows you to use the land to generate a new kind of asset, a biodiversity certificate.
Right. It is an attempt to create a sophisticated financial market for pure ecology. But gaining entry into this market is incredibly difficult.
I can add you.
Before you even register a project, you have to pass a strict fit and proper person test.
What does that actually look for?
The regulator scrubs your entire history.
Have you ever been convicted of environmental crimes or fraud? Have you ever breached an enforceable undertaking?
Wait, what is an enforceable undertaking? Is that just like a contract? It's much heavier than a standard contract. It's a legally binding agreement you make with a regulator to fix a past screw-up, usually as an alternative to them taking you to court.
Oh, I see.
So if you've had a history of making those deals and breaking them, the government is not going to trust you to repair nature.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So let's say our founder passes the background check. You can't just, promise to plant a few trees, take some photos, and ask for a certificate, right?
Definitely not. The project has to follow a methodology determination.
Okay.
And these methodology determinations are rigorous legislative instruments. They dictate exactly what activities you must do, and crucially, how you will scientifically measure and verify the enhancement of biodiversity.
So I have to actually prove the ecology is getting better. How do I do that? Am I just going out and counting koalas?
It is much, much more granular than that. Depending on the methodology, you might have to install acoustic monitors to track the population density of specific bird calls over time.
Wow.
You might have to take regular soil core samples to prove the microbiome is recovering.
Really?
Yeah, or conduct grid-based botanical surveys to show invasive weeds are being eradicated. The evidence has to be clear, convincing, and comply with strict biodiversity integrity standards.
So if you do all that, the regulator finally issues you a biodiversity certificate.
Correct.
And under Section 72 of the Act, this certificate isn't just a gold star for being a good citizen. It is legally defined as personal property.
Yes, that's the key innovation here.
You can transfer it, you can sell it on the open market, you can even leave it to someone in your will.
The Act establishes a framework for the Commonwealth government itself to purchase these certificates. They can run tender processes or reverse auctions to buy the best biodiversity outcomes for the public.
And corporations can buy them too.
Absolutely.
But there is a massive bold print caveat here that we really have to clarify for you. When people hear about trading environmental certificates, they immediately think of carbon credits.
Right, the offset model.
Yeah, where an airline pays someone to plant trees so the airline can keep polluting. But Section 76A of the Nature Repair Act drops a hammer on that idea.
It really does. It states unequivocally, a biodiversity certificate must not be used for an environmental offsetting
Not
purpose.
at all.
Nope. Even if a state or territory law attempts to allow it, this federal rule completely overrides them.
So what does this all mean? It means the core philosophy of this act is genuinely about adding to the net positive column of nature.
Precisely.
It is actively restoring biodiversity, not just generating a mathematical permission slip for a mining company to bulldoze a wetland somewhere else.
Exactly. If you buy a biodiversity certificate, you are buying the intrinsic value of repaired nature. Full stop.
Which is a beautiful concept.
It is, but it raises a pretty terrifying reality for any landowner actually considering it.
So.
Because earning that certificate is not a casual 5-year startup pivot. If the founder chooses this path instead of the subdivision, they are taking on a monumental burden.
Right, the timeline.
The Act defines permanence periods for these projects. You have to choose a Type A period, which is 25 years.
Okay, 25 years is a long time.
Or a Type B period, which is 100 years.
100 years.
A century.
You are legally binding yourself, your children, and your grandchildren to a specific set of land management practices.
Yes. And the reporting requirements are intense. Once that certificate is issued, you are locked into submitting Category A biodiversity project reports for the duration of that permanence period.
So for 100 years, someone has to file this paperwork.
Yeah. And these are not simple self-assessment surveys. These reports are subject to mandatory audits by registered greenhouse and energy auditors.
Oh, wow.
You are legally required to provide them with all reasonable facilities and assistance to inspect your compliance on the ground.
And what if you fall behind? The Act mentions civil penalties of up to 200 penalty units for failing to submit a report. What does a penalty unit actually translate to in the real world?
A penalty unit is a standardized fine amount used in legislation so the government doesn't have to constantly rewrite laws for inflation.
Okay, that makes sense.
Currently, a single federal penalty unit is around $313. So 200 penalty units isn't a slap on the wrist. That is a fine of over $62,000.
Wait, $62,000 just for being late on paperwork?
Yep. And there is a continuing penalty for every single day you remain late.
That is massive financial exposure. Mm-hmm. And that's just for the reporting. But the physical risks are even more daunting, right?
Absolutely.
What happens if nature decides to unrepair itself? The Act is very clear on natural disturbances. What if a catastrophic bushfire rips through the Huon Valley and incinerates your entire 69 hectares?
You do not get a free pass just because it was an act of God. You are legally required to notify the regulator within 60 days that a significant reversal of the biodiversity outcome has occurred.
And the regulator has immense power in that scenario.
They do. They can forcefully extend your permanence period to give the land time to recover. Or, in severe cases where the habitat is just completely gone, they can issue a relinquishment notice.
Which means what, exactly?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, a relinquishment notice is the ultimate nightmare scenario. It means you have to give the certificate back.
Wow.
And if you've already sold it, say, to the Commonwealth or a private buyer to fund your life, you have to go out into the open market, find an equivalent certificate, buy it at whatever the current market price is, and relinquish that one to the government to balance the ecological books.
The financial risk of a lightning strike suddenly becomes a massive regulatory liability.
Yeah. It's terrifying.
It really highlights the agonizing choice facing the landowner in Signet. On the one hand, you have the subdivision pathway.
Right.
You battle the local zoning codes. You hunt for translation glitches in the geographic mapping data. You chop the 69 hectares into 3 pieces and you sell 2 of them.
You walk away with cash.
You walk away with cash, but you permanently lose control of the ecology.
On the other hand, you have the Nature Repair Act. You keep the land whole. You protect the habitat.
Yeah.
You generate a tradable certificate based on measurable scientific proof. But in exchange, you enter into an intense, century-long legal marriage with the federal government,
yeah,
taking on decades of audit costs and the looming threat that a single bushfire could ruin you financially.
It's an incredible journey we've been on today through your sources.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we started down in the weeds at the absolute micro level, looking at a single piece of land in Tasmania.
Testing lot sizes against median neighborhood data to fight a local zoning ordinance.
Exactly. And we dug into how the mathematical translation of map coordinates could accidentally invent 6 hectares of land.
A glitch in the matrix.
Right. We followed that thread all the way up to the macro level of sweeping federal legislation, exploring the mechanics of a national biodiversity market, 100-year conservation contracts, and the heavy burden of guaranteeing ecological outcomes across generations.
It's a lot to process.
It is. But here's where it gets really interesting. Because it all comes back to that tension between the physical dirt and the invisible rules that govern it.
Absolutely.
We are looking at a future where technology allows governments to perfectly map every square inch of native vegetation on your property from space.
Yeah.
At the same time, they're creating sophisticated financial markets that assign hard dollar values to pure ecology, which leaves you with this thought to mull over. Are we entering an era where the true financial value of a piece of land is no longer based on what a developer can build on it, but rather on what a landowner promises to never do to it?
It's a profound shift. I mean, you're monetizing the preservation of the earth and taking on the liability of guaranteeing that preservation for a century.
Buying time, not just geography. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.